Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. With me today is Chris Bailey. Chris wrote an excellent book, The Productivity Project: Accomplishing More by Managing Your Time, Attention, and Energy. Chris, this book comes out of a year of productivity. Chris graduated Carleton University in Ottawa and spent a year really playing with, experimenting with the sort of me-search idea of productivity and how to really optimize how effective he is in the world. And out of that project came a book. And we are lucky enough to have Chris with us here today to talk about being productive. Chris, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for having me on the Bregman Leadership Podcast, Peter Bregman. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good.
So let's start with what is the Productivity Project? Give us a synopsis.
Like a Cole's Notes. What do you have over there? I think it's Cole's Notes here in Canada. Cliff Notes?
Is that what you have?
Cliff Notes. Cliff Notes is what you've got. So I graduated university a couple years ago. And when I'd been into productivity for about a decade leading up to that point. So when I graduated, I received a couple full-time job offers from these big-ass companies. But I thought, you know, if there's a time to explore this curiosity, you know, some people have normal interests like cooking and sports, I guess. But people like us are wired a bit differently, I think. I've always been deeply curious about productivity in the sense of not this cold and corporate and all about efficiency idea, but in the sense of accomplishing what we intend to and just getting more done every day so we have more time to do the things that are meaningful to us. And so when I graduated, I looked at how much money I had in the bank account. I had about 12 grand that I'd saved up. That's Canadian dollars. So US, you got to adjust. It's a lot less in US dollars.
$15.
Yeah, it's like 50 cents US, I think at this point. It's basically monopoly money. You know, you could walk into a store here in Canada and pay with no, you can't. That's a lie. But I figured that's enough money to make it through a year of exploring this curiosity that I had. And so I took a year out of my life, declined those jobs, and ran a series of productivity experiments on myself where I used myself as a guinea pig to experiment with what it takes to push our limits and of what we can accomplish every day. And it was also first and foremost a research project. And so looking at all the prevailing academic literature and books about productivity that were out there, including yours, naturally, to see what it takes to get more done every day and how much we can actually do.
So I'm going to ask a weird question coming from me to you, both of us having worked on productivity.
The weirder, the better, as
far
as I'm concerned. Which is,
why should we care about productivity? Meaning if you're sort of talking about happiness or quality of life, and I think about, you write a lot about meditation, I write a lot about meditation, and the idea that, you know, really the quality of our lives is to be present to the moment that we're in, why is accomplishing things so important?
I think it, you know, the best approach to that question is to think about the definition of productivity in the first place. And I think a lot of people, it was funny in the book, The Productivity Project, my initial title for that book was The Productivity Playbook. That was the one we sold it to the publisher with. It's a little inside baseball, but my editor really convinced me to rename it The Productivity Project. And when I started talking to people, I was a bit worried about the project moniker, but I realized that the hesitation that people had with the title was the word productivity, because you think of productivity, I think a lot of people, they think to a spreadsheet. But the approach that I've always taken, and especially you know, being into meditation and that sort of thing, is that productivity is very much a process of becoming more deliberate about our work as well as our life. Because when we work and live with intention, when there's intention behind what we're doing and we're not doing everything on mindless autopilot, that's, I think, where the magic of productivity is born. It's in that deliberateness that productivity exists, I think. And so when you kind of equate the two with one another, I think it's a much warmer definition of productivity, but it's a definition that scales across your entire life. It's not just about working faster, 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 harder, harder, harder. It's about working on the right things and getting more meaning and value out of them at the same time.
So it's really about being strategic and intentional in a sense in terms of what we're doing and how we're doing it and why we're doing it. And when exactly. we have that piece, then we're accomplishing things because those are the things that give us joy.
Exactly. And you know, you got to do some things that you don't want to do naturally. I think everybody on the planet does. So there's the meaning bit that makes something value, but also the value bit. So I do a lot of things every day that I don't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily pick them to do every day, but because they allow me to accomplish a lot in my business, in my life, you know, I do them.
So after a year, what was your most interesting discovery?
It was kind of the bigger picture of productivity, you know, in addition to that deliberateness. It's funny how most of the lessons that I uncovered over the course of the productivity project, I uncovered when I was putting the book together. So after the whole year, and so I didn't really uncover the lessons until I stepped back from that entire
it's
project.
So interesting, and it doesn't surprise me at all. The element of reflection versus just experiencing is huge.
Yeah, you see everything from that higher level perspective that you don't necessarily get when you're immersed in it. And so it's interesting that relates to productivity too, is the most difficult time to invest in your productivity is when you're immersed in your work. It's when you take that step back and kind of ritualizing taking that step back every morning by defining your intentions for the day, every week as well in general and throughout the day. So you can kind of realign what you're spending your time, attention and energy on to what you're working on and what you should be working on. It's a very curious idea, but in addition to the deliberateness idea and that intentionality that has to exist, I think it's the bigger picture of productivity, that it's not only about managing our time, that we have other ingredients to manage too. Attention is one that's in the most demand. If our time is the most limited, our attention is the one that's in the most demand. In any given moment, there are countless things that we can focus on that are in front of us. Every moment is like that big Netflix grid. When you fire up Netflix and you see the 50 shows that you can jump into for things to watch, we have that in front of us throughout the day. You know, we have a bunch of windows open on our computer. We have our phone. We have maybe a book off to the side. I have a terrarium right here on my desk. You know, we have so many different objects that we can devote our attention to. And so being deliberate about that is a key. And energy is another crucial ingredient of productivity, because if we burn out, if we don't get enough sleep or do simple things like that, our productivity will be toast as well. And so it's when you dive deep into an idea like productivity, you begin to see just how many elements contribute to how much you get done every day, including, and those would be the three ones that I would identify, are time, attention, and energy.
Let's play with attention for a second, because I think it's an interesting one. And we've all had this experience. I know I certainly have had the experience where I'm trying to, write something, for example, or do a particular piece of work. And it's fitting those categories of it's not boring, but it's hard. It's really challenging. I'm coming up against roadblocks. And every part of me is screaming, like, go eat a snack or go,
pick up your phone.
Check your email. Do something like that. And so there's the observation. I mean, I was listening to NPR yesterday, I think it was, and they were talking about multitasking. Yeah. And I thought to myself, this is such an old story, right? Yeah. I mean, I've been writing about multitasking for, 5 or 6 years now at least. And there's been researchers who've been writing about it for 10 or 15 years. And we know that multitasking is bad. There's no question about it. There's no opposing research that says, actually, multitasking is a really productive habit and everybody should do it. Nobody's saying that. No. And yet, it is almost irresistible to multitask.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, people do it all the time. So you're working and you you know, multitasking isn't even getting dissuaded from working on a challenging piece of work. But the challenge itself is the same, which is how do we maintain our attention during these difficult times? How do we prevent ourselves from following tangents that we know are not productive and yet, you know, almost irresistible?
I think it comes down to changing the environment that we allow ourselves to be in when we're doing work. And so, you know, in any moment, if you have a more attractive potential object of your attention than the work that's in front of you, and so you're trying to, you know, write a book in one window on your computer, but then your emails open in another, and it's constantly giving you alerts. And you know, so many people that that I coach and work with, they have that Outlook notification in the bottom right hand corner of the screen that pops open all day, constantly derailing their attention. And I think that's the best solution to that. Is it's so much easier to manage your attention when you deal with these potential distractions ahead of time.
Shut everything off, put yourself in a closed room.
Exactly. And realize that your work will not be the most attractive thing that will be in front of you. You know, doing email will always be a sexier task than doing work. It's more stimulating, it's more engaging, and a lot of times it's more fun. You know, you don't accomplish as much as it, so it doesn't make you more productive, and it's usually not all that meaningful. But, you know, being a traffic cop isn't, chances are that's not your job. Chances are your job is to, you know, whatever, engineer a new product that people will end up using or whatever it happens to be. And so eliminating these potential objects of attention ahead of time, I found that to be one of the best things, instead of trying to resist them in the moment. When I was writing the book, I wrote most of it while disconnected from the internet, because you know, one study I encountered said that we spend 47% of our time on the internet procrastinating. And so quite literally, things take us twice as long when we're connected to the internet, especially when basically everything on the internet is more attractive than doing actual real work.
I mean, there's something profound about that, which is the realization, the recognition, the acknowledgement that these other distractions, the internet, email, et cetera, will be more interesting and more fun.
Yeah, and they almost always, or else we wouldn't spend time on them.
Right.
Right? We wouldn't want to do that instead of doing actual work.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we just have to decide for some period of time, I'm not going to do it. How about when you have to go on the internet for work because you have to research something that you're writing about and you go on the internet? Do you get sucked in? Like,
oh, of course. Yeah. And you know, I'm as bad as anybody. When I wake up, I pull my phone out from the other room. Sometimes I'll lay in bed and bounce around between the same 5 or 10 apps, you know, just checking email and then doing this other thing, then this other thing, because it's so easy to lose grip of our intention when we're on the internet, because it's a candy store for our brain. You know, we bounce around between so many different engaging things when we're connected, but it invariably makes us less productive. But and I would challenge folks who are listening to perform an experiment like that one, kind of a mini productivity experiment, if you will. You know, when you need to do something on the internet, what were you looking at? You were looking like up.
I was looking
was there
up.
A fly?
No, I was looking up because this is the disadvantage of having a Skype video
along with video call.
No, I was looking up to see Cal Newport's book, Deep Work.
Oh,
who's a great, it's a great book and he's a great guy. And he has completely shut off, like he does email, but you know, privately to the side, he doesn't do very much email. He's not on Facebook, Twitter. And I was sort of looking for it there because one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, you know, should you actually make a more permanent decision? So, you know, you're saying that you still check Twitter in the morning and you still, you know, go back and forth between Instagram and Facebook.
That's not a bad day, yeah.
why not drop all of that completely? Why not pull out of, I mean, this is Cal's perspective, right?
Yeah.
Pull out of all of those things. I mean, if you actually look at the research about book sales and things like that, it doesn't actually really help that much. And so why not actually create a life that's truly distraction-free?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of value in that. You know, there's value in being connected, but that I don't think there's a problem with technology when we use it with intention. But the problem is that it's so difficult to use technology with intention. So if you're disconnected and you find that you need the internet for something, and you know, you say, okay, I'm going to do that one thing on the internet, you get there, you might, and you probably will, end up being sucked into this black hole where you bounce around between a bunch of different things. And it's because that intention is so easy to lose a grip over. Right. You know, something that I do, and I might have mentioned Twitter and the app thing, but I don't have Twitter on my phone. And it's because I found that I was most likely to lose grip over that intention when I fired up Twitter, you know, because there are so many rabbit holes that you can dive down into that. What I do is I have an iPad here, and that's kind of my distraction machine. I don't have Twitter on my computer. My password is 20 or 30 characters long, and I have it written down. It's underneath my couch if anybody is interested in robbing me and for my Twitter password. But what I do when I want to connect with it on my computer for whatever reason is I pull that piece of paper out from underneath the couch. And because there's enough temporal distance between wanting to check Twitter or having the urge to check Twitter and pulling that password out and typing it in, I end up not doing it. And I kind of compartmentalize the social media to that one device. And that's the device I use for Instagram, even though the Instagram totally sucks on the iPad. But when you're deliberate enough about compartmentalizing these things, while you question what you need them for in the first place. I don't have Facebook as an example because I found I wasted too much time on it and that I didn't get enough value out of it. But, you know, I enjoy checking Instagram and I enjoy checking Twitter and staying connected with the people that I follow. And, you know, I get value out of that. So why get rid of it in order to live without distractions? You know, I think you got to have some enjoyment too, naturally.
Right. And so that's your enjoyment, but you coordinate off.
Yeah. You got to compartmentalize that from the work, the actual work that you're doing, I think.
Let me switch gears here a little bit. You mentioned a super interesting MRI scan in your book between your sort of self and a stranger and your future self. Could you describe that?
Yeah, for sure. The research shows that if you put somebody in an fMRI machine, which is a brain scanning machine, functional magnetic resonance imaging. Thank you for bailing me out of that one. But and then you ask them to think about their future self, so themselves, but in the future, and then you ask them to think about a total stranger, what you'll notice is pretty interesting. You'll notice that the two scans are pretty much identical to one another. And so the idea is we see our future self as basically a stranger to us. And so this is why we have a bunch of, you know, nature documentaries loaded up in our Netflix. I'm on the Netflix bandwagon right now.
I can see what you've been doing all morning.
Yeah. Before we were chatting, I was binge watching. No. you know, we buy classic books. We buy Dickens books that we're, you know, quote unquote, bound to read someday. So we put all these things off and we're more likely to save, we're less likely to save money for retirement. We spend it today instead of thinking about our future self. And so the more we see our future self as a stranger, the more likely we are to put this stuff off for our future self to do. And this is a major reason why people procrastinate. You know, we procrastinate not only because other things in front of us are more attractive than the actual work, but because we are disconnected with our future self. You know, we see our future self as a total stranger. You know, if you ask somebody if they wanted to run a marathon 2 years from now, you know, they might agree to it because they can see this sepia tone image of, you know, oh, you know, running through the finish line and having a, you know, a good time and everything. But it's because they're disconnected with their future self that they fail to see what they have to actually do to get there. And I think that disconnect can cost us quite a bit in productivity if we're not careful.
You know, I it's why it's so easy to delegate to ourselves in the future, is because if there's work I don't want to do, I'm going to give it to someone else. Even if that someone else is me, but if I see them as a stranger, then I'll give it to someone else, which is me in the future who I'm not really identifying with.
It's why we say things like, yeah, I'd love to grab coffee with you in 3 weeks, Peter. Sure, that works.
Now I know how you really feel.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding.
Chris, share you have a beautiful little trick to remind yourself of your future self. Share that with listeners.
I forget what that is.
It has to do with a picture of you.
Oh, I have the picture, but nobody will see it because we're on video. I don't know. It's at the top of my bookshelf.
Oh, I see it actually. I see it. So describe what it is.
It's not very high resolution. It's like a little pixel on your screen probably. But the idea is that I've framed and printed off a picture of myself, but in the future. And so what I'll look like 40 or 50 years from today. And I used an app called Aging Booth on my phone, and anybody can download it. I think it's available for pretty much every platform. And what you do is you take a selfie of yourself, and it shows you what you'll look like as an old person. And you know, they add wrinkles, they add all sorts of different effects, and it's semi-realistic. But what it does is it gets you thinking about yourself, but in the future. It's a good little cue. If I find myself procrastinating on something, I'll look up at future Chris up there, future 70-year-old Chris, and it works. It's a stupid trick, right? It's actually very stupid. But
you know what? It's the same trick as moving your watch forward 5 minutes so that you're on time places. They work. I mean, even though you know what they are, they work.
Yeah. Even though it's a dumb little trick, it really does work, especially when you put that investment into, you know, ordering. I ordered this from Fracture. They print pictures on glass. And so, you know, when you put in that investment, it really does get you thinking about your future self. And, you know, what also works is writing a letter to your future self, you know, thinking about what things will be like if you start running a couple miles, you know, a day or a week or whatever it might be, or you eat fewer pizzas every week, or, you know, whatever the change might be. Thinking about what things will be like after you've made these productive changes can be really helpful too.
That's great. There's something that you write about that actually was also sort of profound for me in reading it, which is, I'm not going to quote you exactly, but that the hard part about productivity is that one decision, let's say I make a decision I want to lose weight, actually represents dozens of small sacrifices in a day.
Yeah.
That's good. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, it's the idea that the idea of a change is always a lot sexier than what we have to actually do to make that change happen. And it goes for any change. You know, losing weight is a good example, because I think most people on the planet have been there. You know, they've gained a few pounds and then you try to lose it. But so the idea of, you know, rocking a six pack by summertime is a really attractive idea. But getting there, you know, it involves making those million small sacrifices along the way. And it goes to the idea that, you know, sometimes a change isn't worth making. You know, we like the idea of the change, but in practice, it's just total hell. One of the things I did for the project was run a lot of experiments on myself, where I used myself as a guinea pig to explore productivity. So I did things like gain 10 pounds of muscle mass and, you know, watched 300 TED Talks in a week to play around with information retention. I worked 90-hour weeks for a month. But one that comes to mind in this example is waking up at 5:30 every damn morning for a few months. And I struggled to integrate this habit into my life for the first few months of my project. But after that, I'd finally done it. You know, I had the stuff that productivity dreams were made of. You know, it's like sunshine and rainbows in my mind. You know, I woke up at 5:30, I meditated, I made a great breakfast, I read the news, I had a coffee before the rest of the world even woke up. Until I realized, you know, a few months into that I absolutely hated that ritual. I hated every second of it. I couldn't stand going to bed when people wanted to spend time together or spend time with me. I found myself, you know, spending way less time with my friends and going to bed when I had the most energy and when I was actually the most productive. You know, I'm a night owl at heart. And so I have the most energy at night. You know, it makes no sense to go to sleep then when I'm the most productive. And that led me to a lot of research on how there's a zero connection between our socioeconomic standing and how and what time we wake up. There's no connection between the two. It's what we do with the hours of our day after we wake up that make the difference in our productivity and in how much we accomplish every day. And so, you know, that's just one example of how the idea of that change, I still like that idea, even though I realized that I absolutely hated it. The idea of that change is way sexier than what it was actually like in practice. And so it kind of plays into the future self a little bit. I did make this connection in the book, but thinking about it now is, you know, they kind of work together. you know, sometimes we're so connected with the idea of something that we forget what it's actually like in practice.
Yeah, and the glamour of achieving the thing is very, in some ways, disassociated with the often drudgery of of actually making it happen, of sort of doing the day-to-day work. And you bring up another point, which is where I think, like, courage is my big thing these days, emotional courage, partially because it's my next book that I'm writing, but but also because, you know, when you buy a red car, you see red all over the place. So I see it all over the place now. But
it's your reticular activating system.
It's my reticular activating system, exactly. The amount of courage we need to be productive means we need to, you know, decide if everybody else is, you know, thinking productivity means waking up early and we're actually going to wake up at 10 o'clock in order to get our work done and go to sleep at 2. And that's what it, that's what works for us. Or just have the courage to be different than the people around us, or the courage to do these small, make these dozens of sacrifices every day in order to kind of get to where we want to go, or the courage to say no to email, or, you know, for some period of time, is really necessary. But I, you know, what I liked, one of the things that I liked about your book is it, there were sort of constant reminders of here's the reality of it, and don't try to twist that reality into something glamorous. Just recognize that those are going to be sacrifices, and decide if those are the things that you want to make, the sacrifices that you want to make.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes to the idea that there's got to be meaning behind what you do. If there isn't that deeper connection to why you're doing something in the first place, where is that courage going to come from? It's going to be an effort to garner that every day. It's going to be a sacrifice that is, in the end, I don't think it's worth making if your work isn't deeply connected to something that you find meaningful. And, you know, I don't think everybody does work that's completely meaningful, but I think there's meaning in work that most of us do. And so finding that deeper connection to that is crucial, I think. You know, having that why, as Simon Sinek might say, that's kind of the depth of our work. If we don't care about our work, it's going to be hard to be productive on a daily basis. It's going to be a slog, and it's, in the end, it's not going to be really worth making. Man, that was a depressing statement, but it, you know, meaning is a beautiful thing once you have it and once you find it.
Yeah, and actually, it actually takes some intention and thoughtfulness to create meaning in things that you might not otherwise see meaning in. So sometimes it just takes a moment to say, why am I doing this? And if, by the way, if there's no reason to do it, then maybe I should just stop doing it.
Yeah.
But if I find that meaning, then it energizes everything else that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much. Chris Bailey, The Productivity Project is the book, Accomplishing More by Managing Your Time, Attention, and Energy. It's much more than a time management book. It's really about accomplishing the things that are most important to you, which is, you know, a topic near and dear to my heart as well. Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.